different parts of the country. There are no leadership challenges happening right now on the Democratic side. There is quite a wide tent, even though I know that there are many who say, no, the Democratic Party is divided. Look at what's happening on Israel-Gaza, for example. Yeah, there are disagreements, but for the most part, the party is really united compared to what you're seeing on the Republican side, which is that a full nearly 40% of primary voters voted for someone other than Donald Trump. And yet Trump is still the nominee. And now a lot of those 40% are saying, I might stay home. I might go from Haley to Biden. I don't know what I'm going to do. So this is a reminder that the now roughly eight year Trumpian takeover of the Republican Party has lost them many elections, is now putting them in potential financial ruin, and they don't seem to have even the most minor ability to get out of this. So there's a couple of outcomes here. The first is very unlikely. Somehow the Republican Party realizes Trump's a disaster. They get rid of Trump as a candidate. They get rid of Trumpists from the RNC. But it seems both too late for that and that there really isn't a majority of Republicans that actually want to do that. So then we get to the most ideal outcome for us on the left, which is they run the party into the ground. They lose the House in 2024. They continue not having the Senate. Joe Biden gets reelected in 2024. It's the end of Trump's political career. And hopefully, MAGA Trumpism is just destroyed, the last vestiges of which maybe just become normal Republicans, or maybe they go away altogether. And then we start 2028 in a situation where the Democrats will be putting up a new candidate because Biden will be term limited, and Republicans will have to come up with something other than MAGA Trumpism. And maybe we have a new awakening in America. That's the most optimistic perspective. The alternative is unfortunately very ugly, which is that this insane fundraising scheme and selection of Trump once again leads to four more years of Trump in the Oval Office. And then in 2028, whoever is the heir apparent to MAGA Trumpism, maybe it's Don Jr., maybe it's Eric Trump, maybe it's Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't know. These are all very scary names. Try to take over and MAGA Trumpism continues. So for me, the stakes are clear. And part of it is I welcome the financial disaster that is the Republican Party. It's thanks to Trump, but it's potentially a good thing for the left. Let's make sure we don't squander this opportunity in 2024, because it really is feeling like an inflection point. And that's a point I'm going to continue to make as we get closer to November. Hey, it turns out that Osama bin Laden's niece is a Trump supporting QAnon believer. And there's actually a lot of interesting stuff here. Now, yes, politics can make strange bedfellows. And I saw a funny comment on Reddit about this saying, I can already see her at the Republican convention. Obama killed my uncle, which would not be totally untrue. But I think that we actually have to go a little deeper with this story. Business Insider has a report about Noor bin Laden. And it says Noor bin Laden, the niece of terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, revealed that she's a big fan of President Donald Trump in an interview with The New York Post. Quote, I have been a supporter of President Trump since he announced he was running in 2015. I've watched from afar and I admire this man's resolve, said the Switzerland resident. So she does watch from afar. Trump has been accused of spreading anti-Muslim hate, but Noor bin Laden claims the U.S. would be better protected from a second 9/11 under Donald Trump. So here's the really interesting thing about this. First of all, I don't blame people for their relatives. It's very clear, at least from everything public facing, that Noor bin Laden does not share any of the terrorist sensibilities of Osama bin Laden. She's denounced it very clearly from everything I've read. So I don't blame her for her relatives. She can be horrible on her own terms. And the fact that she has bought into a bunch of this QAnon stuff is certainly a part of why she's horrible. Here is a post on Twitter where she used the WWG1WGA, where we go, one, we go all, I think is what it means. It's a sort of QAnon slogan with the hashtag QAnon and QAnon worldwide. So I think the most important takeaway for me is that these wealthy elites actually have a lot more in common than you might think if you just look at the divisions among religious or ethnic lines. And even though many on the right very loudly talk about how, oh, you know, these rich Qataris and these rich Middle Easterns and these rich bin Laden families and others, and They wrap all these things together. The truth is that wealthy elites of any religious background often have more in common with each other than you might think. And this is yet another example of that. And so does politics make strange bedfellows? Yeah, it does to a degree. But at the end of the day, Noor bin Laden, as a comfortable, wealthy elite of a different religious persuasion than Trump and many of those that, you know, she's very different than Mike Lindell in a lot of ways. But at the end of the day, she believes a lot of the same things, and much of it has to do with personal financial interests. So when we see the.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It is a shock. What happened was not small, really. While coming on the way in the car, I saw things. The destruction is unbearable.
Israel's war on Gaza hits the six-month mark as Israeli ground troops withdraw from Khan Yunis, leaving behind a city in ruins. We'll get the latest with Palestinian physician and activist Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Then we continue our conversation with international law professor Neve Gordon.
The situation in Israel, and Israel admits to it that it controls the area from the river to the sea. And so the situation is that there is one state. The one state is a settler colonial apartheid state. And our project now is how to democratize it.
And millions of people across the U.S. will be donning protective glasses to witness the solar eclipse today. We'll speak with a NASA climate scientist about the phenomenon and about climate change, how greenhouse gases in the atmosphere have reached new record highs. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinians are returning to the devastated city of Khan Yunis after Israel withdrew troops from southern Gaza to prepare for an attack on Rafah. Residents of Khan Yunis say the city has been largely reduced to rubble and smells like death. The temporary troop withdrawal comes 6 months after Israel began its assault on Gaza following the Hamas attack on October 7th. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 33,100, but many fear the actual number is far higher. The Guardian reports tens of thousands have disappeared in Gaza over the past 6 months, with their whereabouts unknown. On Friday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres repeated his call for a ceasefire and the release of all hostages still held in Gaza.
More than half the population, over a million people, are facing catastrophic hunger. Children in Gaza today are dying for lack of food and water. This is incomprehensible and entirely avoidable. Nothing can justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people.
On Friday, the head of Save the Children U.S., Yanti Sirepto, addressed the U.N. Security Council.
350,000 children under the age of five are at risk of starvation as we speak. The world is staring down the barrel of a man-made famine. The hunger in the north is of a particular concern, where people have now resorted to eat animal feed or tree leaves. If we continue down this path of all parties to conflict, flagrantly breaching the rule of war and international humanitarian law, zero accountability, powerful nations refusing to use the levers of influence at their disposal, then the next set of mass deaths of children in Gaza will not be from bullets and bombs. It will be from starvation and malnutrition.
More video has emerged from Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza, which was largely destroyed during Israel's two-week siege. This is Jonathan Whittle of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs speaking on the grounds of Al-Shifa.
We're here in what used to be Shifa Hospital in the north of Gaza and Gaza City. Hospitals should always be places of safety. Hospitals should always be protected, places of healing. and yet I'm standing around in the midst of utter devastation. Shifa has literally become a graveyard. There are bodies still in this courtyard. The buildings have been completely destroyed.
The International Court of Justice has begun a hearing today in The Hague to decide whether Germany has violated the Genocide Convention by providing military and financial aid to Israel. The case was brought by Nicaragua, which accused Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide in Gaza. Nicaraguan Ambassador Carlos José Arguello Gómez addressed the court earlier today.
In the present case, Nicaragua is also requesting the court to order that Germany to cease providing support to Israel in its campaign of destruction of the Palestinian people. But in the present case, Nicaragua is acting not only on its own behalf on the basis of the rights and obligations conferred by the peremptory norms invoked, but also on behalf of the Palestinian people that is being subjected to one of the most destructive military actions in modern history.
The ICJ hearing is being held as Al Jazeera reports a group of 600 civil servants in Germany have written to Chancellor Olaf Scholz, calling on him to immediately cease armed deliveries to Israel. In Washington, D.C., 40 Democratic members of Congress, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, have written President Biden urging him to halt new arms transfers to Israel following Israel's killing of 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen last week. The lawmakers wrote, quote, "In light of the recent strike against aid workers and the ever-worsening humanitarian crisis, we believe it is unjustifiable to approve these weapons transfers," they wrote. Talks over a ceasefire and hostage deal are continuing in Cairo, but there are conflicting reports on how much progress has been made. Israel and Hamas both sent negotiators on Sunday, a day after CIA Director William Burns arrived in Cairo. In Israel, as many as 100,000 protesters rallied in Tel Aviv on Saturday, calling for a deal to release the hostages and for new elections. One of the most prominent Palestinian prisoners jailed has died from cancer in an Israeli prison. The novelist Walid Dakka had spent the past 38 years locked up after being arrested for killing an Israeli soldier. Rights groups have been pressuring Israel to release him, saying he was in dire need of medical attention. Last month, Amnesty International called for his release, saying that since October 7th, he'd been tortured, humiliated, and denied family visits. Protests over Israel's assault on Gaza continue across the globe. In California, 20 students at Pomona College were arrested Friday after occupying the office of the school's president. The students were protesting the removal of a mock apartheid wall that had been built on campus. The students were also calling for Pomona College to divest from companies aiding Israel's occupation. The International Atomic Energy Agency is warning recent drone strikes on a nuclear reactor at the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia plant in Ukraine could increase the risk of a major nuclear accident. The IAEA did not say who carried out the strikes, but Russia's accused Ukraine of carrying out 3 recent drone strikes on Zaporizhzhia, the largest nuclear plant in Europe. In other news from Ukraine, Russia's continuing to intensify its attacks on Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city. On Saturday, at least 7 people died in drone strikes that hit residential areas. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned Ukraine could soon run out of air defense missiles.
The current intensity of Russia is quite high. As of today, we have a reserve of air defense missiles, but I believe we need to think about tomorrow. The intensity could stay the same, and then we wouldn't have enough. If they keep hitting Ukraine every day the way they have for the last month, we might run out of missiles.
Zelensky's comments come as Republican lawmakers in Washington remain deeply divided over sending more military aid to Ukraine. The embattled Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's expected to unveil a new Ukraine funding bill in the coming days. The United States, Japan, Australia, and the Philippines are holding their first joint war exercises in the South China Sea. On Thursday, President Biden's planning to host Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. at the White House. On Sunday, the Chinese military held surprise Navy drills in the South China Sea to counter the U.S.-led war games. Over the weekend, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen met with Chinese Premier Li Qiang in Beijing. Yellen said U.S.-China relations are now on a, quote, more stable footing.
As I have said, the United States seeks a healthy economic relationship with China that benefits both sides. But a healthy relationship must provide a level playing field for firms and workers in both countries.
During an interview on CNBC, Yellen refused to rule out tariffs on Chinese green exports as China ramps up production of solar power technology, electric vehicles, and lithium batteries. Mexico's cut diplomatic ties with Ecuador and withdrew its embassy personnel from Quito after Ecuadorian police and military forces raided the Mexican embassy Friday to arrest former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass, who had taken refuge there for months. Mexico had granted him asylum protections just hours before dozens of police and military forces stormed the Mexican embassy. Glass served under former leftist Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa. Glass is being investigated for corruption and was previously convicted on graft charges, which he and allies have denounced as politically motivated. The raid on Mexico's embassy in Quito has sparked condemnation across Latin America and the world. This is Mexican Foreign Minister Alicia Bárcena.
Mexico repeats its condemnation of the violation of the immunity of its embassy in Quito and the aggression towards its staff. As per instructions of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, we are coordinating the return of all our diplomatic staff in Ecuador, along with their families, after the violent attack carried out by the Ecuadorian police in our embassy on the night of Friday, April 5th.
Rwanda is holding a week of commemorations marking the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide, during which up to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by militia members. Rwandan President Paul Kagame said in a speech Sunday, the international community, quote, failed all of us. This is Alan Nagari of Human Rights Watch.
That this should never happen again. And we have a classical example of a country that at the time was seen to be of no strategic importance when the lives of so many people were at stake. We had a United Nations peacekeeping operation that was that was effectively dismantled, and its size was reduced drastically at the point where the Rwandan people really needed the international community to speak up and actually reinforce that peacekeeping operation. And because the international community failed to do so, then we lost over 800,000 people.
In 2021, French President Emmanuel Macron acknowledged France's role in failing to stop the genocide. Declassified U.S. documents show the Clinton administration refused to label the 1994 mass killings in Rwanda as a genocide. One State Department document read, be careful, genocide finding could commit the U.S. government to actually do something, unquote. Israeli President Isaac Herzog traveled to Rwanda for the 30-year commemoration, where he met with President Kagame. Kagame has been president since 2000 and has led a harsh crackdown on the press. He's also accused of fueling deadly violence in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. Donald Trump pulled in $50 million at a campaign fundraiser hosted by the billionaire hedge fund investor John Paulson. At the fundraising dinner in Florida, Trump told supporters he would extend his 2017 tax cuts, which aided billionaires. Meanwhile, ProPublica is reporting Trump's legal team may have violated ethics rules by not telling an appellate court that a billionaire financier had agreed to help Trump post the full $464 million bond set by the court in his civil fraud case. Despite the offer from billionaire Don Hankey, Trump's lawyers told the court it was a practical impossibility to pay the original bond, which was then lowered to $175 million. In Vermont, a man has been arrested over a suspected act of arson on Senator Bernie Sanders' office in Burlington. Authorities say security footage captured the suspect spraying what appeared to be accelerant outside the office door Friday morning. A motive has not been identified. A Federal Aviation Administration is investigating after the engine cover on a Southwest Airlines Boeing 737-800 plane fell off during takeoff, striking the wing flap and forcing the aircraft to return to Denver's International Airport. It's the latest high-profile incident on a Boeing aircraft as the beleaguered company comes under mounting scrutiny over its safety failures. And millions of people across the United States will be donning protective glasses this afternoon to witness a much-anticipated solar eclipse. In New York, Sullivan County, six prisoners at the Woodburn Correctional Facility will be among those gathering outside to view the rare event. After winning a lawsuit that argued forcing them to remain indoors was a violation of their religious beliefs, the prison has issued a lockdown during the time of the eclipse, which will peak in New York around 3:25 p.m. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, Palestinians in Gaza have been making their way into Khan Yunis today, a day after Israeli forces announced they are withdrawing. We'll speak with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti in a minute.
There's a toilet on the roof in the sky. Don't care. Blood enemies and holy fools in the sky.
The Skies Don't Care by Rasha Nahas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinians in Gaza have been making their way into Khan Yunis today, a day after the Israeli military announced it had withdrawn its ground troops from the area. Israel first invaded Khan Yunis, Gaza's second-largest city, in December. 4 months later, the city is almost unrecognizable. Scores of buildings are destroyed or damaged. Streets have been bulldozed. Piles of rubble have replaced where schools and shops once stood. The withdrawal brought Israeli troop levels in Gaza to one of the lowest since the war began. Yet Israel is still vowing to invade Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city, which is sheltering some 1.4 million people, more than half of Gaza's population. Meanwhile, talks over a ceasefire and the release of hostages are continuing in Cairo, but there are conflicting reports on how much progress has been made. This all comes as Israel's war on Gaza hit the six-month mark on Sunday, a grim milestone. Over 33,100 Palestinians have been killed, including over 14,000 children. Nearly 76,000 people have been injured. Tens of thousands are missing. About 1.7 million people have been displaced. The United Nations is warning that famine is imminent. To mark the 6 months of the war, World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus wrote on social media platform X, quote, "The deaths and grievous injuries of thousands of children in Gaza will remain a stain on all of humanity. This assault on present and future generations must end. The denial of basic needs, food, fuel, sanitation, shelter, security, and health care is inhumane and intolerable," he wrote. Meanwhile, the International Court of Justice began 2 days of hearings today to consider Nicaragua's request that emergency measures be imposed on Germany over its support for Israel's war in Gaza. Nicaragua is accusing Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide in Gaza. For more, we're joined by two guests. Mohammed Shahada is with us, a writer and analyst from Gaza, chief communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, columnist at The Forward newspaper, a Jewish weekly in New York. He's joining us from Copenhagen. And joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank is Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. He's a Palestinian physician, activist, and politician who serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dr. Barghouti, we want to start with you in Ramallah. Can you explain what you understand has happened in Gaza at this point, the six-month mark, and also the significance of Israeli troops pulling out of southern Gaza, but saying they are doing that in preparation for an assault on Rafah?
Well, I think you have a combination of two factors here. The first one is that Israel has created a terrible devastation of all of Gaza Strip. We thought that the destruction in the north of Gaza and in Gaza City was the biggest. But now we discover that the destruction they've caused in Khan Yunis is even bigger. Probably more than 80% of all homes and houses have been destroyed, partially or completely. They are trying to make Gaza uninhabitable. They've destroyed totally the infrastructure. More than 405 schools and universities have been destroyed. 33 hospitals out of 36 have been completely damaged. And they've been killing people around the clock. We are talking in 6 months, actually, the number of people killed is no less than 40,000 people, if we include 7,000 who are still missing under the rubble and who have no chance of being alive. In addition to, as you said, to more than 76,000 people, to make it clear to people, this is more than 5% of the population of Gaza Strip. And if that had happened proportionally in the United States of America, you would be talking about more than 12 million people killed or injured in 6 months. It's a horrible devastation. I mean, the suffering of children in particular hurts, breaks my heart. When you know that 1,000 children have lost their limbs, as one child asked his father, he's 5 years old, and he lost both of his hands, and he was asking his father, "Father, will my hands grow again when I grow up?" This is the kind of severity of what's happening there. But that's one side of the issue. The other side of the issue is that Israel has failed drastically in achieving any of their goals. Their goal, their main goal, was ethnic cleansing of Gaza. The heroic Palestinian population remained in Gaza, did not leave. 700,000 people still are in Gaza City and in the north, regardless of the bombardment, of the killing, of everything. And people do not want to leave their homeland again, as has happened in 1948. But also Israel has failed in destroying the resistance. They have failed in bringing back the Israeli prisoners by force, and they have failed to impose their control in the area. And that's why practically, wherever their tanks remain, they are subjected to also resistance from the Palestinian side. That's why they are withdrawing, but that doesn't mean they're not going to come back. The risk of what they are doing is that they're taking back their tanks and their infantry, and allowing the airstrikes to continue in the most possible severe way, which is very devastating because people in Gaza have nothing to defend themselves with against the airstrikes. Also, it is clear that Netanyahu is maneuvering. He's pressured severely by the whole world now to stop this terrible genocide, but he wants to continue because his own political survival depends on the continuation of this war. He knows very well that once the war stops, he will be investigated for his failure on the 7th of October, his failure in this war, and he will be, of course, tried for 4 cases of corruption, each of which could take him to prison. So he wants to expand the war if he can. But the reality is that Israel is killing Palestinians now in three ways. It is killing Palestinians with bombardment. They've used more than 70,000 tons of explosives. By the way, about 30,000 of that was given by the United States of America. It is like 30 kilograms of explosives for each man, woman, and child in Gaza. It is more than double the explosive power of the two nuclear bombs that were thrown on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the Second World War. But that's not all. They use bombardment to kill people. They use hunger to kill people. We have 700,000 people practically starving in the north of Gaza. And they use diseases. We have 35 medical teams from Palestinian Medical Relief Society working now in Gaza. And they report to us that about 1 million people in Gaza today are sick with different diseases, skin diseases, infections. And there are certain epidemics that already started. We have an outbreak of infectious hepatitis. We anticipate more outbreaks of epidemics because children have not received vaccination for more than 184 days. It's a devastating situation, but that's why the whole world must stand up now with Palestinians and tell Israel enough is enough, and genocide must stop, and it will not stop unless there is immediate and complete and permanent ceasefire.
So what do you think is happening with the pullout of the troops? Ben-Gvir said on X today, the security minister, if the prime minister decides to end the war without a broad attack on Rafah in order to defeat Hamas, he will not have a mandate to continue serving as prime minister. Of course, the extremist Ben-Gvir and if they pull out of the government coalition, Netanyahu will no longer be the prime minister if Ben-Gvir and Smotrich do that. But also, you have the conversation that Netanyahu had with President Biden. Of course, we don't know everything they've said. There's a massive protest in the United States demanding that Biden demand an immediate ceasefire, end arms sales to Israel. This latest news, 40 Democratic members of Congress, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, have written Biden urging him to halt new arms transfers to Israel following Israel's killing of seven aid workers from the World Central Kitchen, this horrific attack that took place this week. But it must also be galling to politicians, to Palestinians, that it took this horrific act this week to call attention to close to 200 other humanitarian workers who are Palestinian who were killed, 400 medical staff. Overall, of course, over 33,000, if not much more, Palestinians killed in Gaza over this 6 months. But this international attack, since there were people from Australia, Britain, Poland, the United States, Canada, all killed together, put enormous pressure on President Biden. What do you think the U.S. is doing, and what does it need to do, Dr. Barghouti?
Well, first of all, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are not extremists. They are fascists. And this whole Israeli government does have now a fascist nature. If you look at what they are doing to our prisoners in jail, or what they are doing to the people of Gaza, or even the West Bank, where more than 460 people have been killed also. It's a fascist approach, and these guys want Netanyahu to continue the war. And he wants to continue the war. But if we have to thank anybody for the increasing solidarity with the Palestinian people and the change in the political situation, also in the United States, we have to thank the people of these countries. The people of United States, the people of Europe, the people of many, many countries in the world who are now in an actual uprising in support of Palestinian people and against this terrible genocide that has exceeded anything before. And I think this public pressure is the main reason why Biden had to change his position, because he knows very well that he will lose elections if he continues like that. I think the vast majority, you know the figures better than me, but I think the vast majority, the majority of the American public now are against the policy of Biden when it comes to supporting Israel in this terrible genocide. And unfortunately, if the United States wanted, they don't need to waste time. They can immediately force Israel to stop this war. Netanyahu and his fascist government and the Israeli government cannot continue this war without American supplies of weapons, of bombs, which continue, by the way, up till now, and the planes and the political support in the United Nations Security Council and in other places. Now the United States government itself is under pressure because also of another factor, which is the fact that ICJ, International Court of Justice, will most probably decide that what's happening and what happened is genocide. They say it's a plausible genocide. This will hold the United States also responsible for committing a war crime. So I think all these factors are there, but we need even more pressure. And I really salute all the American honest and noble people, including the American Jewish people, who are demonstrating against this terrible genocide and preserving the human values of humanity and pressuring Biden. They should continue this pressure because Netanyahu did not give up and he is still trying to maneuver. He will try to make the negotiations in Cairo fail and use that as a justification for a new attack on Rafah. We know they are preparing for a new attack in Rafah. We know that Netanyahu even tries to escalate in the north and have a military confrontation with Iran and with Lebanon if he can. And that explains why he went and attacked a consulate, a diplomatic consulate of Iran, violating every norm of international law. So in reality, we are facing here a group of aggressors who would like to continue this war and even expand it, who are very angry at their failure. And by the way, I think part of the American administration anger at Netanyahu is that they really gave him so much time, 6 months beyond any expectations, and he still failed to fulfill his military goals and failed to achieve what he promised he would do.
I want to bring Mohammed Shahada into this conversation, writer and analyst, communications chief at Euro-Mediterranean, Human Rights Monitor. Double the explosive power of the bombs used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki have been used on Gaza. I wanted to ask what these 6 months have meant for your family and friends in Gaza. You are from there. And about a report that you all put out, a report that Euromed Monitor put out about killing starving Palestinians, targeting aid trucks, etc.
Basically, by now, every single person I know in Gaza was exposed to the scene of decomposing bodies. And virtually everyone I know heard the noises of their neighbors, friends, down from underneath the rubble, and they couldn't do anything about it. It's even too dangerous to try to rescue people. And everybody I know, at least almost everyone in my family, had their homes bombed. It expands to my circle of friends. At my work with Euromed Monitor, we lost at least 5 team members. One of our team members found his mother executed at Al Shifa Hospital. He saw her decomposing bodies lying there on the ground. And it's not just the mass killing that is the problem. It's the deliberate, intentional targeting of civilians, the disregard, complete disregard for human life that we're seeing on full display, and the cruelty of the killing itself. We see bodies flattened by Israeli tanks, turned into mush, crushed by Israeli tanks and armored vehicles. We see people hacked into pieces by Israeli missiles and shells. And we see people having their arms bound, their eyes blindfolded, and then executed, especially at Al-Shifa Hospital. So the nature, the cruelty of the killing is very striking in that sense, especially that it's very open. They're not even trying to hide it. And that it's incredibly underreported on. It doesn't make it to any mainstream media, basically. The other dimension that we see there is the people, the amount of people, the hidden iceberg of about 70,000 to 80,000 people who have been maimed or burned severely or wounded critically without basically any appropriate medical treatment or the possibility to go out of Gaza and seek medical treatment. At the moment, it's only very, very meager, very minor numbers of people that are allowed outside Gaza to get medical treatment. And hospitals in Gaza, the majority of them have been fully compromised by Israel surgically, one after the other, in broad daylight, without any sort of condemnation from the U.S. or the European Union. We see also the mass destruction, as you alluded, twice the amount of bombs that were used in Hiroshima. There's an estimate that it's about 70,000 tons of bombs that were dropped on Gaza. And we recently see Israeli officials admitting in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz saying that we could have achieved the same military objectives with about 10% of the damage, but, quote, cruelty was the point. There's an attempt to make a message here. There's also the unethical, extremely insane use of artificial intelligence in targeting people. There's also the very bizarre notion that the Israeli soldiers or Israeli troops, commanders, they set up virtual, quote, extermination areas in Gaza. Any person that crosses that area or happens to be in that area is executed at the spot or detained and tortured at the Sidi Taiman Israeli military base, where thousands of Palestinians are being held at that black spot, away from any sort of legal purview, without being charged or put on trial. And they are subjected to daily torture in every sense of the word, in the most unimaginable ways possible. They're being electrocuted, burned with cigarettes, urinated upon, spat upon. They have their arms and legs tied at all times. They are forced to squat down and sit blindfolded, tied again arms and legs for weeks. If they are sleep deprived, if they try to sleep or speak to one another, they get beaten up by soldiers immediately. And we recently saw a report from Israeli doctors last week in Haaretz again. One dissenting doctor wrote a letter to Israeli ministers warning that we're all complicit in grave violations of the law, because Palestinian detainees, or even political hostages at this point, they are mass arrested as a bargaining chip, therefore political prisoners or hostages. They had, some of them are routinely, quote, having their legs amputated from wounds of being handcuffed, both arms and legs, for weeks and weeks and months. And then there is the last dimension of the engineered systematic starvation throughout Gaza, but most prominently and most severely in the north, where, as Dr. Mustafa said earlier, we have about half a million to 700,000 people stuck in the north of Gaza, refusing to leave. Israel is continuing a process of ethnic cleansing in the north up until now. They continue to drop leaflets on people, telling them to move south if they want food, if they want safety, although the south is just as ravaged and compromised and devastated as the north. And we see Israel not just preventing aid from going to the north, but targeting anybody, literally anybody, that tries to secure the aid trucks coming through, prevent looting, and ensure fair distribution. Around the time that Israel invaded Al-Shifa, in fact, one of the reasons why they invaded Al-Shifa is the civil government in Gaza was operating from there after virtually all government facilities around the north of Gaza were destroyed and razed. They had only Al-Shifa to operate from there because there was electricity and access to people, and they can organize from there an emergency committee that can be in charge of securing the delivery of aid and its fair distribution. It worked out on the 16th and 17th of March very well. That was the first time since the war started, in about 170 days at the time, that aid made it all the way to Jabalia and was distributed to people without any disruption, without any looting, without any chaos. The day after, on Monday, that's when Israel started invading Al-Shifa, and assassinated, targeted assassinations against key figures that were responsible for securing the aid. So we see this very deliberate, very engineered starvation process of people in northern Gaza to ethnically cleanse it and force them out, but also to sustain chaos in the entirety of the Gaza Strip, to sustain the loss of civil order, and to bring about a societal collapse in whole or in part, to push it to the deepest conscience of people in Gaza, to the deepest of their minds the idea of leaving, that it should be their only ticket to survival, to achieve the Israeli goal of population transfer, what they refer to as thinning the population. They call it voluntary migration, but in fact it's ethnic cleansing. And we see that process still on full display. And we see a very systematic, deliberate conscience effort to make Gaza uninhabitable for decades to come.
Before we end, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I wanted to ask you about one of the most prominent Palestinian prisoners who has been jailed. He's died from cancer in an Israeli prison. The novelist Waleed Dhaka had spent the past 38 years locked up for his involvement with an armed group that abducted and killed an Israeli soldier in 1984. Rights groups had been pressuring Israel to release him, saying he was in dire need of medical attention. Last month, Amnesty International called for his release, saying that since October 7th, he'd been tortured, humiliated, and denied family visits. Can you tell us about Waleed Dhaka and the effect of his death in prison?
Well, Waleed Dhaka is the 14th prisoner who dies in jail in Israeli prisons since 7th of October. The 13 others were beaten to death. In this case, Waleed died because of cancer. But Waleed Dhaka suffered from medical negligence for years, not only recently, but especially recently. Waleed Dhaka finished his term, by the way. The ruling was that he would be in jail for 37 years, and that period finished, but they wouldn't release him. They kept him through new military orders, knowing that he's having cancer and that he needs urgent treatment and he needs to be with his family. But the most inhuman behavior was the fact that they did not allow his wife and his daughter, his only daughter, to visit him since the 7th of October. And while knowing that he was in terminal stage, just about to die, they refused to let them even come to his prison and say goodbye to him and see him for the last time. That kind of behavior is savage. And I think that's the nature of the treatment. And to add insult to injury, Ben-Gvir, this fascist minister of interior security who is in charge of prisons, Israeli prisons, declared that he is sorry that Waleed Dhaka, this famous novelist and writer, and who especially wrote for children, he said that Ben-Gvir said he was sorry that Waleed Dhaka died because of cancer and was not executed by the Israeli military. This is the kind of mentality we have to deal with. And by the way, I mean, while we are talking, I have to really mention, I've just been recently able to visit some of the injured people from Gaza who are being treated in other countries. And these are not just numbers. When we say 75,000 people injured, there are 11,000 people in need to be treated outside because there is no treatment for them in Gaza, like the 10,000 cases of cancer. But the people who got out, I met some of them. One of them was a woman who lost her hand, lost her leg, lost her husband, lost her three children, actually, and now she's left alone. Another one lost her sight. A third one is now paraplegic because she was hit in the back, and so on and so forth. It's a terrible situation. And you know what hurts me a lot? Is that when six white people from Poland, Australia, and Britain were killed by the same Israeli army, and of course we are absolutely shocked that they were killed while they were trying to provide humanitarian aid. But because these six people who are internationals and not Palestinians, the whole world was up in arms and the United States was criticizing Israel. But we didn't see the same reaction to the 40,000 Palestinians killed so far, including almost 15,000 children, and including, by the way, the seventh person from this international group who was a Palestinian. I think this kind of discrimination and racism is something we should all stand up against, because at the end of the day, What Palestinians want is very simple. We want freedom. We want self-determination. We want to be equal to everybody. We want to be treated as equal human beings. And it is the duty and responsibility of every person in this world who believes in humanity to be on the side of the Palestinian people. This is not a time to be neutral or to ignore this terrible genocide that is taking place against the population of Gaza.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I want to thank you for being with us, physician and politician, General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, and Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst, communications chief at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, speaking to us from Copenhagen. Dr. Barghouti speaking to us from Ramallah. And I should add that Ben-Gvir, the cabinet minister, who is threatening to pull out of the government if Netanyahu doesn't have the Israeli troops invade Rafah, was himself convicted of inciting anti-Arab racism and hatred and supporting a terrorist group. Coming up, millions of people across the U.S. will be donning protective glasses today to witness the total solar eclipse. We'll speak with a NASA climate scientist about the phenomenon and about the climate catastrophe. Stay with us. Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler. Yes, people will be donning their glasses today to watch the solar eclipse across parts of the United States. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a moment, we're going to look at that. We're also going to look at the climate crisis, as scientists warn three of the most significant human-caused greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, reached new record highs again last year. That's according to U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which said global carbon dioxide levels are now over 50% higher than they were before mass industrialization due to the burning of fossil fuels, deforestation, and livestock agriculture. New data has also confirmed that March was the hottest ever recorded and the 10th consecutive month to set a global heat record. Meanwhile, climate scientists continue to raise alarm about the catastrophic impacts of rising temperatures in Antarctica after researchers in 2022 recorded the largest hike in temperature ever measured in the coldest region on Earth. For more, we're joined by Peter Kalmus, climate activist and a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. He's joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Dr. Kalmus. Before we go to the climate catastrophe, I want to talk to you about today's much-anticipated solar eclipse. Millions of people across North America donning protective glasses this afternoon to witness the eclipse when the moon covers all or a portion of the sun. Beginning in Mexico's Pacific coast, from there the path will continue into Texas and across dozens of other states before the eclipse enters Canada in southern Ontario. And here in New York, six prisoners in Sullivan County at the Woodburn Correctional Facility will be among those gathering outside to view the rare event after winning a lawsuit that argued forcing them to remain indoors was a violation of their religious beliefs. The prison had issued a lockdown during the time of the eclipse, which will peak in New York at 3:25. It's been, what, 7 years since the last total solar eclipse? Can you explain it to us?
Yeah, so I did have the good fortune to see the eclipse in 2017 in Oregon, and it was quite stunning, actually, quite amazing, something to see. So, you know, I was trained as an astrophysicist. My training is in physics, and I was an astrophysicist before I was a climate scientist. And I'm going to take this back to kind of my understanding of global heating. This planet, we live on a planet. It's a sphere. It's you're going around the sun. There's the moon going around this planet. And every so often, it's going to go right in front of the sun, and we're going to have a shadow on the Earth, and that's all that's happening. It's exactly the same as any object blocking a light source and creating a shadow, except it reminds us that we are on a planet, and we are in the vast, vast cosmic space, right? The distances between planets and the sun are so huge that it's very infrequent that you get the moon lining up just so in front of the sun to create that shadow that completely blocks out the sun for a couple of minutes. We are on a very fragile place with a very fragile climate system that is very much able to be pushed by humans burning fossil fuels, for example, and that's what we're starting to see as things get hotter and hotter. So I think this is a good opportunity for people to reflect on the fact that we live on a very fragile and beautiful rock in space, the only place we know in the cosmos to support life.
And why is it important that we wear these glasses? As I put them on right now, and now people, there is a rush to get these. I can see nothing just sitting here in the studio through these kind of sunglasses. Explain what they do.
Yeah, well, they basically block a lot of the light from the sun so that you don't go blind and you don't hurt your eyes. So please don't look directly at the sun.
Mm. And what about pets? What about animals? What happens to them?
I mean, eyes work the same in humans as in animals. So don't, you know, I think most animals will have enough sense to not look directly at the sun.
Or to don these glasses. The New York Times had an interesting piece, The Eclipse That Ended a War and Shook the Gods Forever. Thales, a Greek philosopher, 2,600 years ago, was celebrated for predicting a famous solar eclipse and founding what came to be known science as science. Your final thoughts on this, Dr. Peter Kalmus?
I really want to talk about global heating and the climate crisis. So, you know, I think, you know, science is, it seems strange to have to remind people of this, but science is just an incredibly, it's a treasure. It's a human treasure. And we're seeing so much anti-science right now, which breaks my heart. So many people are easily misled by disinformation from the fossil fuel industry, from politicians. It breaks my heart that somebody, for example, who spreads lies and who is anti-science could actually be elected into public office and continue the damage. It's as a society, we're also very fragile. We live in a very fragile climate system, but we're very easily misled by disinformation. And science is essentially the antidote. Science is how we understand reality. And when we don't pay attention to what's really happening, for example, on planet Earth, it's incredibly dangerous. And right now we're in a situation, in my opinion, with global heating, where billions of lives are at risk.
So let's talk about global heating. The solar eclipse apparently brought down empires because people were so frightened by it. We'll see if climate activism takes on governments to change their positions. If you can talk about these firsts that we're experiencing, the last one I talked about in Antarctica, the hottest year on record we just passed there. What does all of this mean, Peter?
Right. So the fossil fuel industry is still expanding. They're controlled by very rich people who have all of the power. The power structures in this society, as you well know, are geared towards the very rich. They control a lot of the media. They spread disinformation. The public right now, because the planet's getting so hot, and as we've seen since March of 2023, as you mentioned, the last 10 months being the hottest on record, it looks to me like we are entering a sort of potentially new regime, a potential acceleration in global heating. The climate scientist community does not have a very good understanding on why things are going so off the charts over the last year or so. It's deeply disturbing to me. The fossil fuel industry is the cause, make no mistake. When that gets expanded, you release more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, more methane into the atmosphere, and that is going to make the planet get hotter. In 2021, six fossil fuel executives went in front of Congress. They were asked directly, is climate change, is global heating an urgent crisis? They said yes. They were asked directly, will you stop spreading disinformation? They would not agree to doing that, which is tantamount to them saying that they will continue spreading disinformation. I cannot think of anything more evil than for people, for these executives and lobbyists and their lawyers to be continuing to profit, to line their pockets at the irreversible destruction of habitability of the Earth. I should probably mention who those CEOs were in 2021 who went before Congress. There were Darren Woods, the CEO of Exxon, Michael Wirth, the CEO of Chevron, David Lawler, the CEO of BP, Gretchen Watkins, the president of Shell, Mike Sommers, the president of the American Petroleum Institute, and Suzanne Clark, the CEO of the Chamber of Congress. So when they are able to kind of block action by essentially bribing politicians, when they control the mainstream media, right, when they buy advertisements in the New York Times and Reuters so that these trusted news sources will not connect the dots. These news sources will report on a heat wave, they'll report on a flood, they'll report on a wildfire, which is climate related, but they will not say that the cause is the fossil fuel industry, that the fossil fuel industry has been lying for decades, has essentially pledged to continue lying, that we're on a trend getting warmer and warmer every single year, getting hotter and hotter, which is why all of these records that are being broken should be absolutely no surprise to the public, right? If you're on an escalator towards hotter planetary temperatures, of course you're going to be breaking records over and over again. And again, I want to reiterate, the cause is the fossil fuel industry. The only way out of this heat nightmare is to end the fossil fuel industry. They will try to distract you as much as possible, talking about things like carbon capture, talking about things like nature-based solutions. It's all distraction. We have to end the fossil fuel industry. Until we do that, the planet will keep getting hotter. We'll see more deadly heat waves. We'll see them coming more frequently, more intense. We'll see more crop failures. We'll see more flooding. Eventually, we'll see mass amounts of climate refugees, geopolitical destabilization like we've never experienced before. And the public is still essentially asleep because the mainstream media is not reporting this with the urgency that it demands as an actual emergency.
I wanted to ask you about climate activist Greta Thunberg, who was detained twice by police at a protest at The Hague in the Netherlands. Before she was arrested, she addressed journalists. This is what she said.
We are here because we are facing an existential crisis. We are in a planetary emergency, and we are not going to stand by and let people lose their lives and livelihood and be forced to become climate refugees when we can do something.
So that's Greta Thunberg at The Hague. Peter, you also have been arrested protesting around climate change. And I wanted to end by asking about this Yellen meeting, Janet Yellen meeting in Beijing. It is said that one point of contention is China's production of green technologies like solar power, electric vehicles, and lithium batteries, Yellen refusing to rule out tariffs on Chinese green exports, despite Biden's declaring climate change an existential threat to the world. If you can weigh in on this.
You know, I remember a moment back when President Obama was elected to a second term. I wrote a letter to the New York Times saying this is a huge opportunity for the United States to take leadership on climate change. And all the economic benefits, the jobs that will come from that. And instead, President Obama expanded the fossil fuel industry, and after his presidency, he bragged about expanding it. We should be looking for all sorts of ways to expand solar and wind and to end the fossil fuel industry. Those are two sides of the same coin. The harder side is actually ending fossil fuels. We should focus on that. But I don't care where solar, where wind comes from, where any of these solutions come from. We need all hands on deck right now. We should, a lot more of us should be getting arrested.
We have to leave it there. Climate activist, climate scientist. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Chris Hedges on the unfolding genocide in Gaza.
He's not only our greatest journalist, he's a moral philosopher. We also speak with journalist Patrick Martin on the hundreds and hundreds of billionaires that we now have in the United States.
This massive concentration of wealth affects every aspect of life in America. Our elections, our media, our education system.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. A week or so ago, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges entitled his Substack report, Israel's Trojan Horse. In the article, Hedges claims that the temporary pier being built on the Mediterranean coast of Gaza by the Biden administration is really not there to alleviate the famine, but to herd Palestinians onto ships and into permanent exile. And Hedges backs up his claim with his citation of statements from top-ranked Israeli officials, including its defense minister, that Israel's true goal in its current war in Gaza is the removal of these Palestinian people still remaining in Palestine once the current U.S.-backed Israeli genocide finally ends. As we know, the situation on the ground in Gaza is already catastrophic in the extreme. The Oxfam report of March 15 accuses Israel of actively hindering aid operations in Gaza in defiance of the orders of the International Court of Justice. It notes that 1.7 million Palestinians, some 75% of the Gaza population, are facing famine, and two-thirds of the hospitals and over 80% of all health clinics in Gaza are no longer operative. And it states that Israel's control of Gaza, and I quote, continues to be characterized by deliberate restrictive actions that have led to a severe and systemic dysfunctionality in the delivery of aid, close quote, end quote, that the Israeli state is using starvation as a weapon of war. And so today on Law and Disorder, we've invited Chris Hedges back to the show to discuss his article and other matters having to do with the Israeli-Palestinian war. Chris Hedges is, as I've already noted, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, having won the prize while working for the New York Times and covering terrorism. He worked for nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent for the Times, National Public Radio, and other news organizations. Hedges is the author of numerous books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Chris Hedges, a very warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Before we get to the issue of the pier and why it's really being built and all of that, what was your reaction to the U.S. abstaining on the U.N. ceasefire resolution? Did the Biden administration, do you think, do that as much or more for political reasons at home as it did for any humanitarian reasons? I mean, after all, Biden is losing support among his base over his